Bienvenue sur Filigrane TV. Aujourd'hui, on va vous présenter R.J. Ellery, Roy John Ellery, qui vient de sortir ce dernier livre en français, qui se trouve aussi dans le rayon anglais, au sous-sol, dans le coffre-fort, Le secret le mieux gardé de Filigrane. R.J. Ellery va nous parler un petit peu de son livre et on va surtout parler du personnage. So, R.J., why did you start writing?
As a young child, I always had the idea that I wanted to do something creative, something artistic. And I was very interested in painting, I was very interested in drawing and photography. My mother was an actress and a ballet dancer and a singer. My grandmother was a ballet teacher. She ran a ballet school. And so I came from an environment where there was a lot of art and a lot of music in the house and a lot of creativity. And as a young child, my grandmother, who really raised me because my mother died when I was 7 years old, my grandmother was very much, reading is important, reading is vital. She used to say that you live only one life, but if you read, you can live 1,000. And so always for me, reading was important. And then when my mother died, when I was 7, I went away to a school where you stay, like an orphanage, for people who have no parents. And I was there for a long time, for 9 years, and I spent all of my time reading. I was not very good in class, not very good as a student, but I loved to read, and I read and read and read. And the it wasn't until I was about 20, and I was studying for my career, my job, and I met someone who was reading a book that they were very passionate about, very driven, you know, very excited about reading this book. And it was like I had a conversation with them, and it was like someone put a light bulb on in my head, like a switch went on in my head. And I thought, that's what I want to do. I want to write books that captivate and create magic stories for people like this.
What did he say in particular that lit the bulb up on your head?
Well, he was reading a book by Stephen King, a book called It. And it was the fact that he had this book all the time, when he was eating, when he was walking, when he was sitting in a break between classes. He was reading this book, reading this book. And I asked him, what's so good about this book? And he said, I'm absolutely transfixed. I am enchanted by this book. And it was the effect, the powerful effect that this book seemed to have on him. And it was, we were talking about situational dynamics earlier, which comes up in Vendetta. The things in the environment that push you in a particular direction, yeah? And it was almost like, here were the situational dynamics for me. This was the little thing that made me, this is what I want to do creatively. I don't want to paint, I don't want to be a photographer, I don't want to be a ballet dancer, I want to write. That was my situational dynamic. And it was the excitement that he talked about in reading this book that really created an effect on me, quite a profound effect on me.
And what kept you on writing about the United States? Because it's very unusual for a British writer to write on the US, and most would have been discouraged by the systematic refusals you had at first.
The reason I write about the United States and not England is that authors, writers are often told, write what you know about. I think it's important for writers not only to write what they know about, but also to write about the things that they're interested in. And their enthusiasm and passion for a subject can come through in the way that they write. And I want to write books about serial killers or the Federal Bureau of Investigation. I want to write books about cities like New Orleans and New York. I want to write about murder investigation, all of this kind of thing. And for me, these kind of stories don't work in England. England is too small. England is like a tiny little island, and it has a very particular type of crime fiction, like Agatha Christie and Arthur Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes. And then more contemporary, it has novelists, great novelists like Ian Rankin, who write about British or Scottish police officers, police procedurals, and it's small villages and towns and little city environments. I wanted to write novels that were much bigger, like Vendetta. Mm-hmm. It's 50 years and it's accurate mafia history, and it's 10 cities like Chicago and, you know, Miami and New York and Washington. And I wanted a big, like a big painting that covered the wall, not a little watercolor for the salon, you know?
Mm-hmm.
This is, and America as an environment works for me for that kind of storytelling.
And do you outline the things you're going to write about ahead of writing them?
No, I'm not organized when it comes to writing a novel. I'm organized with research, and I'm very methodical and very dedicated when it comes to how many hours I work every day. But when it actually comes to plotting or outlining a novel, I don't do that. There's only two things I decide upon when I start writing a novel. For me, the most important thing about a novel is the emotion it creates in the person who's reading it.
Mm-hmm.
So I decide the kind of emotional effect that I want to create in the person who's reading the book. The level of excitement or the emotions I want them to feel, the passion or the love or the anger or whatever might be, the tone, the emotional tone of the book. And the second thing I decide is the location. And with Vendetta, my location to start the book was New Orleans. With Sur Le Silence, I wanted to write a book set in Georgia at the time of the Depression, before the Second World War in America, mm-hmm. and give an idea of a small town in the south, very poor, farming mm-hmm. community. The location is very important to me because it changes the history, it changes the politics, it changes the way people speak, it changes religion, it changes so many things about the characters that the location for me is as important to character as the people in the book. So those are the only two things I decide. Mm. And a general idea of the kind of thing that I want to write. Aside from that, I don't work it out.
And what were the particular emotions you wanted to capture in Vendetta, in A Quiet Vendetta?
Good question. The idea behind Vendetta was to write a novel about the worst type of human being you could imagine. A terrible killer, mm-hmm. an assassin, somebody who works as a hitman for the mafia. But there is something about him, something charming, something real, something honest about him. And by the end of the book, the idea was to have you feel as though you had some empathy, some affinity for him, and maybe you even wanted him to escape. That was really the guiding idea of the book. And it's a big story. It's 500 pages, and it spans 50 years, and it's got a lot of accurate mafia history in it, and a lot of characters. But the principal idea with both characters, both Ernesto Perez, the Cuban who ends up working for the mafia, and Ray Hartman, who is the investigator, the government investigator, that he has his conversations and who undertakes this investigation, the two things that really were most important for them and for me were the issues of family and loyalty and a willingness to persist and find the truth, and that both men had a sense of ethics and a code by which they lived. And both of them were very flawed, and they had a lot of difficulties personally, but they had this idea of what was right, and they both stuck to it, despite all obstacles.
In the book, among all the characters which have all a dark side, mm-hmm. there's Ernesto, who
is the worst.
Who is the worst?
Yes.
He has killed the most, at least.
Yes.
But at the same time, he's also the one who is the most reliable to
yes.
the people close to him, or to the people with which he's had a history. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Well, the thing about both characters, both central characters, because the book is really about two people's lives, it's a biography of two people's lives and how those lives connect, right, on different levels. The thing about Ernesto is there's a quality that Ernesto has, which is the thing that makes you like him in the end, which he says what he's going to do, and then he does it. He doesn't lie to himself. He doesn't lie to other people. He chooses not to tell his children the truth about his own life. But in the end, he even tells them he risks losing his own family because he feels the truth needs to come out. And again, it was that decision to create a character that was the worst type of human being, the most destructive. He kills a lot of people. But the thing that makes you respect him, in a way, is that everybody that he kills is slightly worse than he is. So he almost resonates with you like that feeling that you have that you want to be a vigilante, the feeling that you have that you want to see justice, the feeling that you have that the law is corrupt, that the police are not always able to act. But here you have Ernesto, who, for whatever reasons, has taken it upon himself to do these things, and he feels like he's doing them for the right reasons. And it's that level of honesty with himself that I wanted to communicate. And the point that you made earlier, which is very astute, is that Ernesto in Spanish means honest, you know. And that was a very, you're the first person who's observed that and commented on that to me.
Thank you.
You know, which is a very perceptive thing, you know.
Why didn't you include Cuba in the big adventure?
Because I wanted to sort of encompass an era, an aspect of the history of the Mafia that not everybody knows a great deal about. The Mafia controlled the casinos in Cuba under Batista. Then Castro came in and he threw all the Mafia and the gangsters out and they went to Florida. And then later on, when Castro realized how much money Havana and Cuba were now losing, he brought the Mafia back in as legitimate technical consultants, which was an amazing thing to do. I mean, this guy's a communist, you know, I mean, he's still in power. But he basically brought the Mafia in to control the casinos in Havana because the casinos were basically a significant percentage of the Cuban income. And, you know, had he not done that, then Cuba would have become bankrupt very, very quickly. And I just thought that that was an interesting aspect of the history of organized crime to tell, and also an interesting aspect of Castro's about turn. Mm. He's 180 degree about face.
And you don't seem to condemn him about that. It seems that it's a necessity and you understand it.
Yeah. Yeah.
The condition of Cuba being isolated requires some transgressing.
Yes, yes. Well, it's again, we get back to, you know, how does a society work? The thing that you were talking about earlier, where personal values are held senior to social values, society's values. Well, the interesting thing is that social values tend to be, generally, the personal values that we all agree upon. You shouldn't steal, you shouldn't kill, you shouldn't this, you shouldn't that, you know? We all have our own personal values. All the personal values that we agree upon become the social values. So we all have this common idea of how things should be. Yet we're in a situation often where we have to make a decision to do something that perhaps isn't strictly honest, but it's for the best, for the greatest good. Well, Castro obviously made this decision. For the good of the country, he had to do something illegal, and that was acceptable. So there, the social value rose above his personal value. The social value rose above his political value. The social value rose above his own ethical value because he was trying to do the right thing for Cuba as a country, even though it was against the law.
And what do you think Hartman was pursuing when he, instead of joining his family and quitting his job, kept on working too much? Stressing himself too much. There is this character in the book, I have to explain for the audience, that, well, is in a step before Ernesto, where he asks himself, he's in conflict between his the dark side he likes, that fascinates him, and the family life he's willing to live, but somehow cannot, because of his dark side and the stress it brings to him.
Well, it's also an issue, as with any human being, where they have a purpose, a vocation, that they want to do something that's of value in their life. There is a very honourable viewpoint amongst pretty much everybody that it is good to help people. People generally make decisions based on not only what is good for them, but what is good for the family, what is good for the society. Mm-hmm. And everybody feels a sense of duty and a sense of obligation that they need to do the right thing. And I think Hartman was at a point in his life where he'd made so many mistakes, he chose the only avenue, the only road he could take, which is, I'm going to make something of myself professionally, and I'm going to try and do something worthwhile. So if I get to the end of my life, or if I kill myself with alcohol, at least I will be able to say, I did this, and it was of value, and I did this, and it was important.
And he's unaware of that. He doesn't know.
Absolutely.
Unlike Ernesto, which knows what he's doing, and he only has the heart, Hartman.
Yes. Well, why he chose Hartman to talk to?
Hartman is also a pun on the him having a big heart, but not knowing what's going on in his heart.
Absolutely. And why Perez chose Hartman as a obscure official in the government to talk to. When you get to the end of the book, you understand why Perez chose Hartman above everybody else to tell his story to. Why did he want Hartman? So even in that relationship, you know, you've got a situation where Perez still, in a way, felt he was doing the right thing by including Hartman in his adventures.
And you said at the beginning of the book that the structure is not quite as good as you were, as you wanted it to be, and that we had to excuse you that you were in bad company at the moment. I think the structure of the book is really great, actually, and the way, in the end, you say life is in circles, and your book is in circles.
Well, the comment at the beginning of the book was an apology in case I made any errors, and I gave an excuse for any errors that may be in the book, because I was in the company of such dangerous and crazy people while I was writing it. It was a humorous thing, not a serious comment.
Okay. And this book is very different from the one that was also translated in French.
Sur le silence.
Sur le silence.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Books? Yeah. As with all the books I've written, I feel very much that each story has an important message. I have never been tempted to write a series where you have one character go through several books.
Thank you for that.
And I get very involved, and I do a lot of research, and I am very much in the middle of this world that I create. And then when I've done the book, I want to do something completely different. It's almost like traveling to one country, spending 6 months there. Okay, I've had enough now. I want to go somewhere else and learn a new language, or meet different people, eat different food, experience a different culture. And that's the way I feel about my books, is each one has to be a world all of its own. Each one has to be special, and each one has to be important and have a message to communicate and evoke as many emotions as possible.
You told me earlier that in order to write your books fully, you avoided reading contemporary authors, and you only did it during your travels. You seem to read Ian Rankin lately.
Well, no.
And who else are you reading?
What I mean is when I'm writing a book, I tend not to read any other authors. Mm-hmm. I tend not to read at all while I'm writing, because and a lot of authors feel this way. If you're writing a book in a particular style, and you're reading lots of authors who write in different styles, you can find that those styles and ideas creep in when they shouldn't. And then when I'm traveling abroad and on tour, I tend to read as much as I possibly can. I read many different books, many different authors. I read crime fiction, I read literary fiction, I read historical fiction, I read non-fiction. I read as much as I can. I never read enough, and I'm always trying to read more. And I have a study with piles of books that I've not yet read. And I know it's important to read, it's vitally important to read, and I try and read as much as I can.
Which is the next book you're going to read in your pile of unread books?
The next book I'm going to read. I just finished, the book I last finished was The Executioner's Song by Norman Mailer. The next book I'm going to read is a collection of short stories by Annie Proulx. Its English title is Just the Way It Is. And it's a new collection of short stories by Annie Proulx, the author who wrote The Shipping News. So I'm looking forward to that because I like Annie Proulx a great deal.
Thank you very much, Archie.
You're very welcome. Thank you.